Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me is my co-host and co-GM,
McGill.
And it is episode 169. Nice. We only get to do that every 100 episodes. And we're recording on the 7th of November, 2023. And, so you are a GM today because we are back wallowing amidst Wicked Ones.
That's right. We're looping back to Wicked Ones. Tom, you and I talk so often, and we talk about RPGs so often, that I can't keep track of what we've talked about on the podcast and what we've said just off the air. So this might be repeating myself because I can't remember if it was on here or not, but you challenged me after we covered Wicked Ones in the RPG Danger Room to run a campaign of Wicked Ones. Do you remember if that was on the show or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely come up. We talked about it at the very least.
I really can't keep it straight what we've talked about on here versus what we've talked about in our lives.
Pretty sure anyway.
But because you challenged me to run a campaign of Wicked Ones, I am doing my homework. I am going through the very large rules source book and learning how to play the game. And then as I've been doing that, you too have been learning to play, though you've only been learning to play using the solo rules, right?
Man, to the extent that they exist, my dude.
Yeah, so since Wicked Ones is on my mind, and you've been playing it too, and soon we will both be playing it together, I figured we might as well go back, revisit it, and do a deeper dive into the rules and just talk about our experience with it. And then I fully expect that we will also discuss the Wicked Ones campaign on this show after I launch it and we start playing.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, I'm down. I got more opinions about it now, probably, to say and whatnot. And as for my side of the podcast, I mean, I have my ongoing 5e campaign to talk about. We've got the Heroes of Coyote's Aegis. They have some like pre-battle objectives to complete, and we'll be getting to those. But also, you know, we've talked previously about how I had been running this 5e game, Coyote's Aegis, but then more recently, that game went on hiatus, and in its place, I began running Boots on the Ground, which was my custom Forged in the Dark modern paramilitary game. And then, basically, what has happened more recently is, you know, I just wasn't really feeling it. I was feeling kind of directionless. And there was a session where we got together to play Boots on the Ground, but then one of the players was just not really feeling great. And I was like, you know what? What if we just tried brainstorming like World of Darkness characters and tried that out? And I just jumped into improvising a World of Darkness game. And now I've kept up with that. And that is now, I was initially doing, for the first like three sessions, it was the characters as just mortals. There was a detective and a hacker. And now, after these three sessions, I've had the transition point where now they have gotten to choose what kind of supernaturals they get to be. And so one of them chose vampire, one of them chose mage. And I just wanted to talk a bit about it, that mainly because, so I ran the most recent session of that last night, and I mean, the rundown, like my notes for that session are very concise. They are just a list of scenes. There are so John, who's the detective, who is now a vampire. First scene, John awakens in a featureless cell and is presented with a blood pack with a whispering voice encouraging him to drink it. He does feel a powerful starvation. So he did that scene. John was actually very persistent in resisting the urge to drink the blood and sort of like held out as long as he could and sort of figured out that there was like someone outside the room that he was in through the shadow under the door. Next, we got Argent, who's the hacker. Argent has a vision of being delivered by a Valkyrie. He is informed that he is not bound for Valhalla as he would have died in flight from conflict, but also that someone wants to see him. And so the hacker has this vision that he's being delivered somewhere by a Valkyrie. Then we cut back to John, who meets Solveig, a mysterious young woman who demands that John carry out tasks at her instruction. So this is the vampire that turned John into a vampire. She basically starts once he comes to and he's drank the blood and the door is ajar to the room that he's in and he comes out and there's this woman there and she basically like immediately starts telling him like she has these tasks for him to do. And the first of these is to pay a visit to the hospital in the town of Kristnes and inform the vampire Elizabeth, Hjalmar's daughter, that her problems will be taken care of such that they can be. Meanwhile, then we cut to Argent in the Borgarnes Hospital. I'm probably butchering all these Icelandic names, but who knows? Argent receives a visit from Elena Sigurdar's daughter, who appears to be wearing a dazzling crown. Alina has questions for Argent, but recognizes that he is awakened. Alina makes arrangements to have Argent sent home with a friend before anyone can attempt to transfer him. Because that's something that's been happening, is that the vampires seem to have some sort of control over the hospitals, and they've been having people transferred to different hospitals for mysterious reasons. Of course, it's the vampires, it's to make, they like interrogate people that maybe know too much and things like that while they're in a state of convalescence. So then that scene is the hacker wakes up in a hospital and he's visited by this cop, this woman who appears to have this dazzling crown on her head, and he eventually, basically what it comes out is that she is also a mage and she recognizes that he is also awakened to the reality of magic. And so she is like, okay, we got to get you out of here before somebody tries to transfer you or, you know, gets up to all them tricks. I don't know what's going on, but we got to get out ahead of it. Then we go to Solveig's second instruction for John is to deliver a runestone necklace to the Museum of Snorrastofa and offer apologies to the vampire Jokul for the inconvenience. And so this is basically Argent had taken a runestone necklace that had been bound for this museum that is actually the home of a vampire. And I should have said the transition point that happened before all this is that they were in a car crash. John was driving, something jumped out, they were fleeing a scene, something jumped out in front of him, he swerved, he crashed the car. It wasn't a rigged event, like he did fail his drive check there, and it just seemed like that was the most appropriate time to have like a vampire grab them if they were going to be turned into vampires or things like that. But when the car crash happened, Argent was carrying this runestone necklace that he had basically stolen. But then that in the crash, when John was abducted from the crash, the vampire Solveig took the runestone necklace and is now delivering it to the vampire it was originally intended for via John. So basically we have like all these scenes. Then Argent awakens in his home to find he is being kept company by a religious man by the name of Hrafnkel Arnarson. Hrafnkel attempts to teach John about the nature of the awakening, but there's an interesting thing where I had that character be like his interpretation of the awakening is like distinctly Christian, and so he sort of gives an interpretation to Argent as a new mage that's sort of like very very based on like the idea of like divinity and God and things like that. Which was funny because then Argent as a character, I gave him the option to like sort of seek out a different tutor, but he was like, as long as this guy doesn't make me pray all the time, he can be my magic tutor, whatever. In my notes, the only other things I have written down are en route to rendezvous with Solveig, John is confronted by Birkir Jonsson, who demands an audience with the Kindred. Argent begins tutelage in the ways of magic. Solveig begins to train John in the use of his disciplines. Alina arrives and informs Argent and his tutor of another fatal werewolf attack in the area of Klepjarnsreykir, which is what they were originally fleeing when the car crash happened. And Jonas Thorvaldsen, who's a Nosferatu, seeks out John and Solveig to summon them to see Prince Einar. And those were sort of just like the cliffhanger bits that we ended on. But like, really, like those notes don't even fill like a page of a Google document. And they were like plenty. They fully filled the session last night. And like, I don't know. I thought it was interesting to zoom in on that is like, you know, I've been doing a lot of these like reading transcripts and things and like really going into the detail of sessions. But then, you know, sometimes the only things I write down for a session are just like that, you know?
Yeah. And I'm trying to think. It's difficult for me to remember because, the point is I didn't really have a lot of notes, but I know I have run at least like two campaigns where the majority of it, I was winging it. I was just sort of improvising. And I'd have like a couple pages of bullet point notes. I did these campaigns when I was in university, so I didn't have a lot of extra time to put together stuff. But I know I've run like full-on campaigns where the majority of it is just sort of improvised. I've got, you know, one page of plot points that I've written down, and then bookmarks in the monster manual for the monsters that I know they're going to encounter, and maybe a map that I found in a different source book. And I've just sort of done it all on the fly and rolled with the punches. And it has worked out. So I think that now I, like you, have the inclination to try and prepare as much as possible and like really flesh it out so that, well, not only so that I don't have to remember so much, but so that I can put energy and effort, more effort into every aspect of the campaign. But I don't know. I don't think there's anything wrong with just telling the story off the top of your head and using the resources on the fly as they go. For another extreme, I know that what you did was sort of in the middle.
Yeah, I think it's just interesting to note just like how different it is laying out a session of World of Darkness, where it really just comes down to laying out like a bunch of scenes where it's like, okay, this is the scene where this is going to happen. And then you just play it out and then you go to the next scene. And yeah, it is very, you just kind of feel it out from there. It's, you know, there is a whole system for designing scenes for the storyteller adventuring system, whatever they called it. That does, it breaks things into scenes, but it also has like ratings for like challenge levels based on what kind of challenges you're likely to face. So, like, a scene will have a physical challenge rating of, like, 2, but then, like, a social challenge rating of, like, 5 or something like that, you know?
So when you ran that session, was the majority of it, like, just interactions that the players were having? You were just, like, role-playing conversations and things like that?
Yeah, pretty much. Doing roles. I had a lot of skill checks when they were at the point where I say, like, Argent begins their tutelage in the ways of magic and Solvig begins to train John in the use of his disciplines. Those were both things. It was actually much more with Argent, as I had him do, like, a whole bunch of skill checks to represent, like, him sort of learning different magical skills and things like that. Whereas, like, John sort of just started to, like, manifest his disciplines. Also, I'm curious, what do you think of this, like, this whole session? The two characters were in whole other scenarios. I was basically jumping back and forth scene for scene with two player characters.
I feel like that's the kind of thing that could only work with maybe a maximum of two player characters. Because intercutting, this is another one where, like, man, I guess I got scrambled brain today. I can't remember what I've talked about on the show. We've been doing this for so long now, Tom, 169 episodes. But I think I've talked before about how I try not to intercut too much between different players in different scenes. Like, I find it can be effective for creating tension if players are approaching encounters from different directions and have different perspectives like that. But nothing drives me crazy like having, you know, one player go off on an independent quest and then two other players go off on their own little quest and maybe another player go off on a quest and then having to jump between all of them. It's like the finale of Return of the Jedi. You've got just too many things going on at once.
Man, interesting. I don't know.
But with two players, I think it's just enough. I think it's easy to hop back and forth between them.
I think that definitely is a huge part of it. I'd say beyond that, it worked. I think that it worked on also a level that, like, both characters were sort of uncovering things that were important to, like, the greater mystery of what had been happening over the past few sessions. So even though they're not in the scene, the characters go, like, oh shit, that's who that is, or, like, you know, things like that.
Also
they had the sort of shared experience of each getting to learn each other's abilities, because each one sort of, like, gets to see the other's, like, training montage, basically. So yeah, there was a certain amount of, like, almost like, you know, when the person who's not playing is, like, benefiting from the spectatorship of the other player, basically.
Yeah, I get that.
So I figure we should jump to my side of things with Coyote's Aegis, before we lose too much more time.
Sure, let's do it. And going into this one, I wanted another check-in with you about, like, how close are we to the present at this point?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. The rate we've been going, like, we've still got, like, two or three, like, big battles, and then the better part of, like, the next act that I've done so far. Before we get to the present, so we're doing okay.
But in reality, outside of the podcast, Coyote's Aegis is still on hiatus, isn't it?
That is correct.
So we're gonna catch up. You know, we're gonna catch up.
Well, I mean, we'll see. So we left off with Hex. He's returned to the group after intentionally dousing himself in Gog the Ogre's scent. That was where we left off, was Hex headbutting a big sweaty ogre to try and get his scent on him. Everyone is glad for their rebreather respirator masks. They've got three objectives now. One here in the camp, dealing with their drow allies. And Morgar has marked the remaining two objectives, which are in Ashgrain Outpost, on their map. And so they decide, naturally, to deal with the drow in the camp first, since it's like the closest thing to deal with. So, they find that the drow are gathered at the foot of a small rocky hill in the forest on the west side of the Draelic encampment. There are six of them in total, and their presence is made somewhat unsettling by the fact that they are wearing scavenged Nightside Eclipse armor. If it weren't for the unique situation here in Agaloc, they might have been attacked on sight. Still, the poor condition of the skull helmets and body armor distinguishes this squad from a proper Nightside unit. Five of them carry wakizashi, like the group has seen throughout the area, while one of them carries a shield and a machete. The one with the machete and the shield stands out, a burly drow wearing lighter armor draped in furs. As they see the group and approach, the drow with the machete is addressing the others in a commanding, authoritative tone. He is mid-speech, saying, "We'll find a drow city and live as drow should, in comfort by the work of their slaves," while he absentmindedly strokes a piece of fur hanging down over his left shoulder. "Come, we will drink wine and enjoy life." This drow's hedonistic madness is immediately apparent to the group, but the other drow seem intimidated by him. What did they do? And Jen immediately is like, okay, it looks like he's been brain fogged, and pulls out a flask and says, "I'll get close and distract while Connor tries to restore him." And Connor says, "I'd have to touch him to pull it off. It wouldn't be very subtle." And Jen says, "Drow don't congratulatory hug?" And he says, "Well, we can try. Perhaps we should appeal to the others first." Connor approaches the group. And I say, "You could also attempt to get him to eat a brain cap mushroom." Jen still has one spare untreated brain cap for reference. And Connor comes up and says, "Hail, warriors. Everyone feeling all right? We have healing and medicine if necessary." Connor looks around the group before ending up staring at the machete drow. The drow quietly shrug and murmur that they're fine. The drow with the machete scowls. "I've hardly felt better, and I imagine these others will feel the same once they've joined me and left this foolish endeavor." I feel like I should also give a shout-out at this point before I forget to, I believe it is Sithmor Cain Unbound.
Right, the one we've been talking about lately.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure that this side quest is part of Sithmor Cain Unbound, where you have to deal with the drow that are thinking of deserting or causing trouble, like mutineer drow, basically, before the battle. So I don't want to, I just want to make it clear, like, which stuff is my work, basically, and, you know, which stuff I'm, like, harvesting. So the guy retorts that he thinks everybody's going to feel better once they've joined him and fucked off. And Jent says, so this is a celebration. And Jent raises the flask and cheers to the drow. And the guy with the machete says, now this one gets it. And he looks at the flask and licks his lips. "Tell me, would you mind sharing some of that? I'm a bit parched after my journey through the forest, and I didn't think to bring my own wine." And Jen says, "Absolutely. The Kenku have a distinct liquor we use for celebrating endings and new beginnings." Jen walks forward with the flask and pulls out a brain cap, but is only to be appreciated in the strictest of ceremonies, sharing of food. And Alex says out of character, "I thought you were going to give him the old tequila worm." And the drow's eyes light up at the sight of the fungus. "Ah, yes, now you're speaking my language." And I have everyone roll persuasion with advantage. And Jen is like, "Oh, yeah." And so Hex gets a 12. Connor gets a 24. Jen gets a 29. For a moment, the drow grins manically at Connor before looking back to Jen. Is this medic going to take part two? He chuckles, not waiting for an answer. Give it here. I want to see how hard you strangers party. And Hex mumbles, I ate a ghost once. Gent hands the great brain cap over.
Hex did eat a ghost once.
Eat and then drink and say, and it'll be some guttural yowls that isn't actually a language at all. The drow eats, then drinks, then attempts to mimic the sounds that Gent made, but belches partway through, interrupting himself. In trying to remember what it was to try again, he seems to squint, as though he's suddenly remembered or forgotten something. He passes the flask to Connor. Your turn. And, Gent says, how long does it, or Chantel says, how long does it take for the cap to set in? I say, not long at all. Gent whispers to Connor, looks like you're someone's type. Connor takes the proffered flask and says, to all the friends I've yet to make, and takes a slug. Bark, bark, woof. The drow grins and claps his hands together. All right, you guys are all right. He glances over to the other drow who have been watching the scene in silence. Ah, you know what? Hells, I could go into battle with you folks. I get it. Against that bastard Dengor, it would be a pleasure. So tell you what, I'll be back. And when I return, you'll have 5 times as many drow fighters on your side. Most of them will answer to me, of course, but you've won me over. How's that sound? And Connor says, that sounds quite agreeable. How soon will you return? And he confidently says, 4 hours tops. And he says, then let's be about it. Be prepared for action on your return. And see that you don't forget your wine this time. Connor gives him a wink. The drow smirks, gives a salute and a nod, and then heads off into the forest. Jen says, I think that solved it. The other drow remain in position, ready and waiting for action. Apparently, the allied drow force is about to quintuple in size. In the meantime, the group has 2 more objectives waiting inside Ashgrain Outpost. And, Hex says, let's touch base with Morgar so he isn't surprised by an army of drow showing up. We can hit him up on the way out. Gent will turn to the drow and checks if they're relieved or upset or anything. I'd say they're pretty stoic, expressing the resolve of soldiers ready for battle. Before leaving the Draelic encampment, the group informs Morgar of the situation. Morgar is glad to hear about the good news. Excellent work. I thought we were about to lose support. Now we've got an even greater advantage. Keep it up and this battle will be over in time for supper. Morgar beams. Gent attempts an insight check to read the drow more carefully and gets a 17. I say it's very hard to read them. At best, you can say that they seemed somewhat concerned when you arrived and the drow speaking to them was speaking to them about deserting, but now they're not giving any signs of particular emotion. Gent waves at them and leaves. So, with Morgar informed of the new development, the 2 objectives in Ashgrain Outpost await. The new markings on their map provided by Morgar indicate the location of the forge and the prison camp, both of which have been assigned to them as pre-battle targets. They've been informed that the forge features a magical circle of entrapment used to contain its workers. This containment suggests that the slaves used in the forge may be a critical asset, so the group has orders to liberate them if at all possible. Meanwhile, their orders regarding the prison camp are similar, but with an added twist that one of the prisoners is a bronze shadow dragon that may be in a frenzied state of rage due to its captivity. And, had Alex share the map, which I'm just going to share with you, because now you can see on the map where the forge and the prison camp has been marked.
I remarked before, but I really like this this Roll 20 map that you've put together here.
Why, thank you. Yeah, it's mainly, you know, it's just to show like how deep into the forest and how sprawling these settlements are and everything. So it's up to them where they go first, and Gent says hit the forge first and then prison camp on the way back, like when you pick up groceries on the way home from work. And Alex says, yeah, that seems smart. And so I say, as you head for Ashgrain Outpost, Near the edge of the forest, a dwarf scout signals you and rushes over. He explains that he made contact with a trio of drow wizards sent by the drow resistance. These wizards say they can cast gaseous form on your party to enable you to sneak into the forge via passages that lead from the chasm on the north end of the outpost. They're currently positioned at the bottom of the chasm. The scout intends to return there regardless and man his post observing the north gate with the assistance of these powerful spellcasters, but he offers for the group to accompany him there so that they may take advantage of the wizard's services. Alex says, nice, I think we'll happily agree. So the dwarf scout leads them to the chasm, shows them the spot where he's set up the rope and pinning so that they may easily descend to the bottom of the chasm. I have everyone roll acrobatics with advantage, and Hex and Gent manage to reach the bottom without incident, but as the dwarf is instructing Connor, Connor slips on his way down. Connor falls for a terrifying 30 feet down the massive chasm before his foot catches on a hanging vine. He swings into the wall of the chasm, taking 10 blunt damage. Luckily, however, he is able to grip some of the pinning and hold himself to the wall after striking it. He hangs there, restrained by the foot. He could attempt an athletics check to break free, or the vine could be burnt or otherwise damaged. Connor tries the athletics check. Connor struggles fruitlessly. He's too heavily armored to pull off the kind of move required to reach up to his boot and free his foot. And so at this point, Hex rappels down and tries to cut him loose with the crucifix scimitar. And Hex makes an acrobatics check with advantage. Hex scurries up to Connor with the aid of the climbing gear, deftly slices the vine away, and quickly grabs Connor so that Connor has no trouble grabbing on the climbing gear again. Together, they head back down to the bottom of the chasm. The dwarf scout and a trio of cloaked drow wizards are watching this scene alongside Gent. Gent declares that they clap, not slow clap, like polite golf clap. The drow ask if the group is prepared to infiltrate the forge. They explain that the group will need to drift through the fissures in the wall of the chasm here, southward into the forge, following its intense heat. They will move slowly in gaseous form, so they must make sure they are direct in their course, lest the spell run out early. And Hex says, let's try to stick together. Don't want to come out the other side separated. The drow nod and arrange themselves near the wall of the bottom of the chasm. Are you, what are your feelings on gaseous form?
What are my feelings on it?
Yeah,
Generally, I can't really perceive it, right? Because it's a gaseous form? No.
Yeah, but like, is it a spell you see used a lot in your games? Are you a fan of the spell? What are your feelings on gaseous form, man?
No, I got nothing against gaseous form. I think it's cool when Dracula does it. I wouldn't say that I have a lot of players who use it. I feel like there are other spells that kind of do similar things or accomplish the same goal that people use more frequently, you know, like a Misty Step or they become ethereal or something like that. But
I love gaseous form. It's one of my favorite spells. It's right up there with banishment.
It apart for you though from these other things?
I mean, I guess your point about etherealness is fair. I don't use etherealness very much. I definitely stick to gaseous form. There's something about gaseous form. You know, one thing that I've definitely done is like in Horde of the Dragon Queen, there's a dungeon where I like just skipped into like a level that I wasn't supposed to by gaseous forming through the cracks in the walls. Because it was like explicitly like a dungeon with cracks in the walls and things like that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. There's something like, I guess it's something about the way that like you just become intangible and get away. It's like you say, it's like, it's cool when Dracula does it. But it's, now that you mention etherealness, I'm like, yeah, why don't I like etherealness as much as gaseous form?
Well, I mean, I think just in terms of flavor, gaseous form is a lot more Tom Lando than going ethereal.
It's definitely a thing in Vampire, is like the skills that let you, like the skill that lets you, Haven of Soil, that like lets you become one with the earth and, you know, the mist form and all that. Those are like, even though that discipline, Protean, is not like one of my like top disciplines, it's like I always invest in that discipline because those abilities are really important to me. I don't invest in Protean for the cool Wolverine claws, which I'm sure most people do. Before they're ready to go, Connor cast guidance on himself one last time. The drow ask that they gather before them adjacent the wall. Once they are all in position, they each place a hand on the respective character and utter the magic word. And what's the magic word for gaseous form, McGill? Paff.
Paff. Hey, Paff. You know, I was about to guess.
Paff. With each utterance of the syllable, one of the group turns into mist until they are each a swirl of vapors crawling through the cracks in the wall. As the drow explained, travel by gaseous form is slow. It takes almost an hour to reach the forge, drifting through the stone of the outpost as they are. Luckily, the forge is not hard to find between the memory of the marking on their map and the distinct heat it produces. They still have at least 5 minutes in gaseous form before the spell wears off when they finally arrive. As soon as they enter the forge, they are aware of the sounds of hard toil within. The heat of the place is sweltering, as one might expect. The structure stretches north and south, with pillars lining the northern end, while the opposite walls narrow to a small gap leading to the south end. Even with the tight entry provided to the southern end of the forge, the group can see the edges of the magical circle glowing beyond. Evidently, the circle encompasses the majority of the forge's southern section, since its edges aren't visible at the entry point. And so they move in gaseous form, positioning themselves around the sort of midsection of this forge that sort of stretches. Really, the forge section is to the south, and they are like, and there's a northern section, and they're sort of hanging back in like the middle of that. I can actually, yeah, there is a picture, so might as well include it.
Nice, nice.
So, looking into the southern area of the forge, they see six Azur working the forge, three on either side. Two of these six, who each stand in the middle of the trio of Azur, carry long, curved Odachi greatswords on their backs in place of the Wakizashi that they've commonly seen carried by the forces of Ashgrain Outpost. Also, all of the Azur have shields, but the size of the Odachi would suggest that the Azur can only wield both the sword and the shield if they were of remarkable strength. On either end of the forge stands a large red spiny serpentine creature with a humanoid torso, head, and arms. These creatures stare at the Azur with contempt as they work. Everyone may roll Arcana and Religion.
These figure icons you've got, the top-down ones, those are native to Roll 20, right?
Yeah, I took some pictures of... I took some pictures of dwarves and tinted them orange to be Azur, and then I took a couple of like snake men and tinted them red to be salamanders. However, with the Arcana and Religion rolls, unfortunately, even with Gent's studies at the Bonesong College, none of them are able to identify these serpentine creatures, but we know that they're salamanders. And Gent says, I slept through Serpentine 101. So do these individuals seem like they're enslaved? I say, well, the Azurs are doing the work for the most part, and they seem fine with it, as the Azur usually are. But Azur are basically elemental servants summoned out of the element out of the plane of fire. The red things there with them, but are there with them, but they're not doing the work, and they're staring at the Azur with contempt. I say, considering you've already faced Azur, it's more likely the magic circle is to contain the snake things than the Azur. Though all of them are standing in it presently. And Jen says, cool, I vote we smash. And Hex says, I mean, if they don't want to be in there, could we be seen as allies? Assuming we have any way of communicating. Hex approaches the chamber, and Connor drifts up a bit too. Jen stays back and keeps out of sight, readies their bow. Hex says, hey, what you working on? And I say, so the question is, are you still gas at this point, or have you waited to drop out of gas form, and are you now all in physical form? And Hex is like, oh, right, I don't know if we can talk in gas's form. Hex will wait for it to drop. And I say, no, you can't. And so...
our discussion of gaseous form has really got me thinking about the idea of doing some kind of gasmancer mage, where all of his spells, like his whole spell roster, has to do with, like, you know, his gaseous form, of course, and then like stinking cloud and cloud kill and just all of those good ones. There's got to be some more, some other, like wind gust, I guess, would be in there.
I just
a gas-themed airbender.
I played in like a campaign once that was set in the desert, and the DM let me flavor my gaseous form as I could like turn into sand, like blow around on the wind.
Neat.
So. They're all now in physical form. Gent readies their bow, and Hex goes up and asks what they're doing. And he says, yep. The serpentine creature closest to Hex whips around, eyes wide. The one on the other side is looking at Hex and Connor intently as well. The Azor suddenly drop what they're doing, fully surprised by the sudden appearance of these two intruders. The Azor draw their blades, while the serpent creatures simply stare at Hex and Connor with wide eyes. I have them roll initiative. By the way, I mentioned those Odachi blades. Do you know the Odachi?
The Odachi? Not the Nodachi? Is Nodachi
a
thing?
Yeah, there's the Nodachi and the Odachi.
Odachi. Okay. And Nodachi.
So the Odachi
great sword
is
versus
great sword.
Field sword is the Nodachi. Okay. So the Odachi are these gigantic ones.
I mean, they're both pretty huge.
Yeah, I've seen these before. Wow.
Yeah, so two of these Azor have these end shields, implying they're so strong they can wield both, which is crazy. The Azor with the Wakizashi rush past the large red serpent creature, pushing past it to head through the entryway to the southern part of the forge and engage Hex. The Azor with the Wakizashi surround Hex. One of them comes around Hex to engage him from behind, but instead of attacking, turns and blesses the other Azor, who come charging out with him. Meanwhile, the southernmost of the Wakizashi-armed Azor return the blessing, also sharing it with the Azor with the greatswords, who are still by the forge currently. Chantel says, please tell me they bless by blowing a kiss. The two Azor who didn't bless their allies instead attack Hex from two separate angles. Accordingly, one slash fails to connect, but the other one gets in. They bless with the word Vano. I correct Gent by throwing in my own little magical world word. And so then we jump into a battle with a bunch of Azor, which I don't know that we can. I don't know that we really need to cover all the details of it, and I feel like I've been going for a while already. So maybe I'm gonna break here.
All right. Sure. Before we really wade into it.
I don't know if I want to really wade into it. It's just so much of just like, you know, rolling whatnot, just so ever much piercing damage, etc. Yeah, I don't know.
So here's a question for you, Tom, saying, you know, you don't know if you want to wade into the combat portion of this stuff. Do you feel like after your session in, what's the name of that campaign? The mage slash vampire one?
I mean, that's World of Darkness.
That campaign doesn't have a specific name yet.
I've been calling it Dark Ice because it's set Dark in Iceland.
Ice. After running a session of that, that was very focused on the RP, and it didn't have any combat, right?
Yeah, not really. No, just like skill checks.
Now, are you feeling bored with combat, or is it just that we got out of a big portion of combat in this campaign, and you don't want to go through it again?
I just feel like it's not that interesting to listen to, you know? Like, it's just me reading off, like, a series of, like, numbers and things.
I thought, though, that your sentiment had changed after watching all that Dimension 20.
I mean, I guess it could have. I guess the other thing is just that, like, I feel like, you know, I've been going about 45 minutes now.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, I mean for next time.
Yeah, okay. I mean, if you insist, I'll do the combat next time.
Oh, this isn't me insisting. It's more the question of whether or not combat is boring to listen to or boring to be on the sidelines of has been an ongoing topic for our show. And we just got through a big chunk of Coyote's Aegis that was dedicated to a lot of combat. And now that we're sort of through that portion and into this next part, you saying, you don't know if you want to get into the combat here because it's just a lot of numbers. I mean, I don't know. I feel like this is like a running thing that we've been discussing.
Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like it's better to get like the bullet points down for the combat of like, what sort of stuff happened. Like here, we have them fighting in a forge against a group of Azur who are like coming out of this magical circle, and they've got these salamanders with them, and they start blessing each other, and they've got these big swords. Like there's going to be more of this, like as we go into like the battle and things like that. I just feel like the minute details are just not that interesting content for a podcast.
That's fair. But do you feel differently about that when you're actually, like, in the game? On either side.
Yeah, absolutely.
Be you the DM or the player. Do you find combat much more engaging to just to even listen to?
Yeah, I mean, even just looking at my notes, like, I see, Chantel says, good, I will attack the guy north of Hex with a bow. I got 29 to hit. Say, headshot. 10 pierce and 29 steak. The Azur stumbles briefly as you rattle its helmet with a single shadow bolt that lets out a ringing sound on impact. Like, I'm getting into it. There's a point where someone rolls a 20 and Hex goes pew, pew, pew. you know, like, I shake it up so that, like, it's interesting. I just feel like, especially also, like, a real difference between this and Dimension 20 is that it's, like, it's all me just, like, sort of reading it off. And it just kind of feels weird, like, just reading the transcript like that.
Fair enough. That's fair. So do you want to hop over to the Danger Room and talk a bit about Wicked Ones again?
Yeah, sure.
So, to catch everybody up, We've covered Wicked Ones. We did like an overview in the past. This is the Forged in the Dark system. It's like a system based on the Forged in the Dark rules, but there's a lot more to it. A lot of subsystems that are unique to Wicked Ones. And the thrust of the game is that all the players play as monsters who are like exiles from a previous dungeon, and they work together to establish a new dungeon in a new spot, a new home. It's in the game, it's called a sandbox, but it's really just like, you know, like the valley that you come to, or the region, the local region. There are going to be a few settlements, but it's not like a whole country or anything like that. And yeah, the objective is the players play as monsters who move to a new spot and start a new dungeon, and then trick out the dungeon with creatures and minions and traps, and begin plotting evil schemes and executing them, and then occasionally having to defend themselves from the people they wrong retaliating and kind of doing like a tower defense Home Alone thing where adventurers infiltrate the dungeon the players have established and traps get set off and things of that nature. So it's kind of a dungeon keeper inspired Forged in the Dark game. And now that I've been challenged to run a campaign of it, I'm getting into the nitty gritty with the rules. And something that I've been finding, and I've been talking to you a lot about, is I feel like I don't, less so now, but I'm going into this without a real foundation in Blades in the Dark. I've still never actually played, like, vanilla Blades in the Dark. I've certainly never GM'd any kind of Blades in the Dark game. The only Forged in the Dark game that I played is Teeth, which we've mentioned before.
Not true. You've played Cyberpunk.
Oh, I did play Cyberpunk. That's right. That is also Forged in the Dark. So, you know, I do have experience with the system, but like it took about 10 years of me being a D&D player before I even became a DM, before I even tried on being a DM. And so I am at once learning sort of both sides of this system and the similarities and differences between Wicked Ones and other Forged in the Dark games that I've played. And as I said, the big difference really seems to be these subsystems. Like the characters themselves, their playbooks, all that stuff feels very familiar, especially with Teeth that we've been playing. There are a lot of common traits between them, even though it's not like one-to-one. But then on top of that, there's like this whole thing about the players design a dungeon together, and it's almost like a dungeon keeper, right? It's like a builder game where everybody gets to collaborate on creating a map. And then there's also, I haven't even gotten to systems, there are these systems of crafting and magic that seem to have like pretty extensive chapters dedicated to them, but I haven't gotten there yet. So it's been a real process, and I've been picking your brain a lot, asking you questions about how you go about GMing Teeth and the different facets of Forged in the Dark that seem to carry over between these different games, like clocks. Progress clocks seems to be a big one. And also just like the way actions work and things like that. So Tom, can you give me any like broad insight into these differences between the systems? Like, how do you feel about Teeth versus Wicked Ones now that you yourself are reading the rules?
Man, in Teeth, I can just like take my XP and put it into an ability, an action, and like get better at that action. And this, the only way I'm getting better actions is if I end up bloodied or going feral. So I gotta either stress out or get almost dead in order to get the XP in order to improve my basic abilities.
Something I have been noticing about Wicked Ones is that one of the goals of the game, as stated in the rulebook, is pushing the players to use their stress a lot and go feral and like indulge in being out of control and monstrous. So I guess that makes sense. I didn't realize that that is how you get the big XP in Wicked Ones, but that makes perfect sense with what I've read so far. They're really like they're trying to push you. They really want to push the players.
I will be honest, I am not sure that I get minions. Minions seem kind of nebulous to me in a weird way. So the thing is that minions can get bloodied, but they come in groups of them rather than one person. So it's not one person getting bloodied. It's a group of people get bloodied. And I'm not sure exactly how that is measured. Also, minions are supposed to be able to, like, retreat or just get knocked out or things, or, like, basically avoid death. But then at the same time, there is a minion upgrade called Expendable that makes it so that if they die, you just have an endless supply of them and you don't need to pay to rehire them. And which then implies that there is a thing where if your minions do die, you have to rehire them. Here's my situation, is that in my solo game, I had three goblin cultists. One got totally stabbed to shit by a were-rat shadow dancer. The two remaining goblin cultists nope the fuck out. They were just like, no, no, no. We're running off, because it says they can just retreat. And I'm like, okay, so I'll have them do that. But then the one that I lost, is that guy lost for good? Do I regain them? Like, were they bloodied when the one guy got killed? And this is all stuff that, like, you were saying would be easier if it's just a group of us and we can, like, negotiate what feels good, right? And, like, I feel like as a solo exercise, that is much harder for me, because I'm just stuck in this thing of, like, okay, well, do I replenish the goblin that I lost on the next recovery because they're not bloodied anymore? Or do I have to pay to just get a new, like, just to replenish that one goblin? Or, you know, what do I do? Similarly,
right, because you're learning the system through the sparse solo rules that are available in the deluxe edition, right?
Yeah, and similarly, like, the Shadow Dancer has an ability called Dance of Death, and, like, I had a pack of ghouls that, like, were really they failed on, like, a series of rolls. And basically, so I was like, all right, so the Shadow Dancer uses Dance of Death on them. I think he just, like, makes mincemeat out of them. They've failed so many rolls, and he just, like, tears them apart. And at that, for that, I was like, I think I've just lost those ghoul minions. It makes me feel like, I don't know, it makes me feel reticent to invest in minions when I play this game. Because I feel like they just, I don't know, I guess, particularly the thing is, like, the minions, they're sort of like secondary characters, and I'm not a huge fan of having secondary characters that I play, you know?
I kind of see them more like something out of Crusader Kings, where you're setting up all of these, like, your own personal little court, in a way, with your different little minions, and then to the point where if your character gets killed, you can just start up a new character who's one of the minions, right?
That's true.
Something I have definitely noticed in reading through these rules, and you and I are almost, we're like going through the rules from different directions, and eventually I think we're going to end up meeting in the middle where we both understand different aspects of it. But maybe you've noticed this too. Something I've really noticed in reading the source book for Wicked Ones is there's an abundance of information in this source book. A lot of it pertains to just learning, like, how to get this game moving, how to get the flow of the game going, before then adding on all of those subsystems I mentioned, like the dungeon mechanics and things like minions and all that. And it's pretty dense, and that was what I was finding intimidating at first going into it. But the more I read, the more I notice that really all this source book is doing is, like, giving names to things that naturally happen in role-playing games. Like, I was reading about the whole consequences system. You and I were talking about this off the podcast. and how there are these different tiers of consequences, and the book devotes several pages on, like, outlining the different types of consequence, be it frustrating or deadly or whatever, and then, like, the effect that it all has on the game. But then it all really just boils down to one little box that says, like, hey, you know, the consequences aren't even really a mechanical thing. They should just be done at the GM's discretion. Right?
Yeah, and so this is the thing, is, like, I find reaching for the consequences to be the hardest part of GMing any Forged in the Dark game. And, like, in my case, it was a thing of, like with the ghouls, what it came down to was the ghouls tried setting a snare, failed miserably. The Shadow Dancer sees the snare. Their guard is up. The ghouls try throwing knives at the incoming adventurers. Everyone dodges out of the way because they're already on the alert. The knives clatter to the ground. The Shadow Dancer rushes in. The ghouls attempt to overcome the Shadow Dancer. The Shadow Dancer uses their offensive move, Dance of Death, which as a consequence seems like it's going to be deadly. And also, after all those failures, I felt like their position was pretty bad. And so at that point, I was like, yeah, I think at that point the ghouls just get wiped out. There's no bloodied or anything about it. But yeah, it all comes down to, like, gut feeling, and I don't know, it feels weird to referee myself when that's all it comes down to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's the issue for me is that because it isn't a mechanical feature of the game, I kind of feel like they don't really need to write as much as they have about it. Right? Like, there are all these rules here. Inflicted consequences, paying cost, you know, resistance rolls, here's a list of best practices. Consequences introduce change and challenge to the scene. Consequences don't negate a successful roll. Consequences don't need to be tied directly to what triggered them. Consequences might affect PCs other than the one that triggered them. Consequences can be split up into a few lighter ones. Consequences are open to discussion. Like, these are good best practices, but that just kind of boils down to this idea for me where it's like, if you don't roll well and you trigger consequences, something bad happens, and everybody can talk about what it should be. Like, that's it, right? I just summed up that whole page in maybe a sentence or two.
Yeah, it's just, like, for me, it becomes difficult to say when the consequence should be, like, deadly, I guess.
Feel like with using these as solo rules, any solo RPG, something I really feel it needs is, like, factors outside of the player control, right? Like, when I play Notorious, I roll on a table to see what the encounter is going to be. And then if I fail my reaction, I roll on a different table to see what the consequences of that are. Because an inherent part of role-playing is, for me anyway, is there's got to be some... A role-playing game has to have some factor outside of the player control to make it engaging. Otherwise, it's just a person coming up with a story in their head.
Yeah, but I mean, I did all that, like the Shadow Dancer, like the adventures that I got, the invasion, that was all stuff that I rolled for and generated. It's just that when it came down to the combat, what I think it really needs for solo is something equivalent to the combat mechanics in Notorious, where it strictly tells you, you know, this causes you shock, this makes you bloodied. The interesting thing is that, you know, comparatively, hirelings and adventurers, the people invading your dungeon, they have hearts that you put slashes into. And, like, while the consequences of your actions can be fairly nebulous as you fight them or as your minions fight them, Like, I am very inclined to err towards building a lot of traps rather than recruiting minions or getting creatures in building a dungeon, because the traps have a specific mechanic to them that's like, if you succeed, the player gets to choose who gets hit by the trap and they take a slash to their heart. If you critically succeed, you get to choose two adventurers and hit them with a thing. If you get a mixed success, someone gets damaged, but the GM decides who it is. I really like that, because that feels like a much more solid rule that's like, okay, here is what happens when you get a certain roll, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which, like, I know, I don't know, in some ways I'm speaking against the very spirit of Forged in the Dark, I think, but it's just like, at least on a solo level, I need some level of, like, something to tell me what happens, rather than being like, now you come up with something that happens to them. Like, I'm like, I don't know, based on what I said, they get stabbed to death. Like,
yeah, my suspicion was definitely that the solo rules are kind of an afterthought and probably haven't been tested very rigorously. Have you tried both versions? Because there's the Big Bad Evil Ones solo rules in the source book, but then there's also the Wickedly Solo rules, which are just sort of like a fan created redux of the original version of the solo rules for Wicked Ones.
I haven't looked into Wickedly Solo as much, but like, when I was looking through it, none of it really spoke to me in terms of like giving me a mechanic or something like solving this problem for me, basically, as far as I know. I also don't know where I put Wickedly Solo. I just looked in my downloads folder and I'm like, wait, where is it? Check my RPG folder. Oh, no, I found it. Okay, we're good.
Throughout, another thing that I'm noticing is throughout this source book, like, the thing that keeps being reiterated that we've already touched upon is prioritizing the narrative, you know? And it sounds like this is a common trait among Forged in the Dark games and in Blades in the Dark, where the player states what they want to do, and then together with the GM, everybody sort of figures out what the most appropriate application of a role would be, right? And I know this kind of happens in Teeth as well, where I'll be like, well, I want to do this. Would that, can I count that as a study role? And you might say, oh, I think that's more of a, you know, doctor role or something like that. But because Wicked Ones is pushing this same idea of, like, prioritize the story and the narrative, I kind of feel like it's, like, overwritten. Do you know what I mean? We have just so many rules, but if it really comes down to, especially in this one, I'm repeating things that I've said to you offline, because they really do sum up my thoughts, but like, there are all these different rules and all these different systems in Wicked Ones, and yet the game is basically saying, like, don't sweat it. Give the players a lot of agency as narrators so that they can contribute to the story just as, I would say, just as much as the GM in this case. I don't know. It's almost like paradoxical to me, where they're, you know, we're looking at close to 400 pages of rules here, and yet the bottom line is still like, but really everybody should just be working together to tell a good story and have a good time. And even when it comes to things like consequences, ultimately it's up to the group to come up with the best course of action, the one that feels best within the story.
I think it's interesting to say because the systems and the mechanics and the crunch that is there, I'm really like sort of hanging on to. Yeah, like I'm really reaching for those things and hanging on to those things to like orient myself.
But that's what I mean, is like it's trying to like have it both ways. It's trying to be notorious and Palladium or something like that. Notorious and D&D.
I guess my point is that I'm glad that it is, because if it was all just like improvisational stuff, I wouldn't have anything to grip to.
Do you think that sentiment is the result of you playing solo and needing a bit more external feedback to make the game enjoyable in that regard?
Probably, but it also gives me, I don't know, it also allows me to orient myself as a player in terms of like what my motivations are going to be when we play, you know? Since I know these systems now, like I now, it's actually an interesting thing because I'm planning on playing a shaman. And so I know that there's an ability I can get that basically replaces my minion squad with like a bound pack of spirits that I have control over. And so I'm not cool. Only am I not interested in messing around with the minion system, I also have sort of my own alternative to that system built into my character. But I'm also thinking about like, okay, when I make my character, or in my downtime, for example, I'm probably going to be more interested in creating traps just because I find the system for the traps more satisfying. And I think it'll be easier for you as a GM to measure out. There's just like interesting things like that. Like I have certain choices to make then about like, okay, do I make a bunch of like simple little tier one traps that are basically like just one die to see if they hurt the adventurers, or do I like put time into a four slice clock project and like design like a tier two trap that has like a better chance of injuring adventurers?
Well, I can't wait to see this in action.
Yeah, it like that is like real systemic stuff that I have sort of like gravitated towards, which is funny because I don't necessarily think of myself as that sort of player. But again, I think it's like the nebulousness of certain other things, like, you know, the idea that I'm going to get minions and then I'm just going to have like a lesser character that I control is just like, I don't know, I have trouble sort of grasping that. As grasping that as well as like just making a bunch of traps.
Been watching some gameplay videos, some actual play videos of people playing Wicked Ones, and it's definitely helping me get a grasp on the system and see how things like that work. I guess the thing I'm still kind of butting up against, even though I definitely feel like I have a better handle on things now than I did before, is these sort of contradictions, right? Like all these elaborate rules in one spot and then these more nebulous ideas in another, to the point where you, Tom, are like gravitating towards the things that have very expressly laid out systems just because, you know, they're more decisive, I guess it sounds like.
Yeah, I have, like, a better projection of what's going to happen with them, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'm very interested to see how this plays. But I think that because the players are being invited to, like, really collaborate with the GM on decisions, at least I won't feel like I'm being hung out to dry by the game. I'm not going to be, like, struggling to remember all the rules and stuff, because a lot of the time it'll boil down to all of us collectively deciding things. But anyway, I've been watching these playthroughs to get a handle on it, and there was a scene that happened that I really appreciated, that I felt like kind of gave me a better idea of how to use mechanics like minions and also flashbacks, which I've really been neglecting to use in Teeth. but I'm going to try and use them more effectively because they're flashbacks and Wicked Ones as well. And the idea was that the party, they were trying to kidnap the son of a prominent merchant, and they wanted to approach the spot where the son of the merchant was hanging out. I'm trying to remember where it was, but they needed to be sneaky about getting, you know, they're monsters, so they need to be sneaky about getting close to him. And they had gotten to the point where they were like right outside the gates to the town where their target was, and all the players started going like, geez, but wait, how are we going to get in there? I'm not very stealthy. I'm a brute. You know, what are we going to do? How are we possibly going to get inside? And then one of them, the group, I believe his class was Conniver, but he was like, you know what? How about we do a flashback where I told my minions to ambush and hijack the next cart that is coming down the path this way. And, oh, look, here comes that cart now. Let's hop on board. And I was like, okay, yeah, here we go. This is sort of how you use your these narrative resources that are different than something like D&D to keep the story moving forward. And so something like minions, you know, maybe they're just a narrative tool where the player can be like, well, you know, while I was doing this flashback, my minions were doing that simultaneously, and now is where it comes to a head.
Another thing I considered is that, like, you can sort of, you can design your minions. There's things that minions can be that are not, like, obvious. Like, your minions can just be, like, a bunch. So, like, my ghouls were a bunch of ghoul craftsmen. And one of the ideas for that was that I was going to have them, like, craft stuff in my downtime. But I needed gold to do that, which I wasn't getting a lot of gold, so that also kind of turned me off getting minions. This idea of, like, minions are a line of defense in the dungeon, like, once the dungeon gets invaded, but I think that there's a good possibility that certain minions, like, if I had minions that were designed just to do, like, a downtime activity, I might just narrate them as, like, hiding when the dungeon invasion happened.
It really, now that we're saying it out loud, I am realizing, like, okay, but I guess it is really just Dungeon Keeper. Like, the best way to think about this, to keep track of everything and the function of everything, is to think of something like Dungeon Keeper, where you've got your map and you've got your little guys and you set them to a task, and, you know, the little clock appears there over their head ticking down, and then you get a notification where it says, you know, Goblin number one successfully built an arrow trap, and then you assign them some new task. Maybe the best way to think about it is just straight from the source. Picture in your head playing Dungeon Keeper.
Goblin Shaman number two has made a spirit, an unhallowed spirit zone. It's a magic trap.
Neat. What does it do?
It summons a ghost. The adventurers get attacked by a bunch of ghosts. Yeah.
Nice. Nice. So
we haven't even mentioned that our campaign is going to have the guidance of a theme.
Oh, you mean, well, is it yet? Has that been settled? Yeah, you're referring.
I feel like we're going to be spoiling winter's festivities.
Yeah, it does seem like it's leaning towards that as maybe even the master plan. Yeah, we're playing with Grant and our friend Sarah, and Grant sort of took the reins right off the bat and said he wanted to play a Grinch, which I ruled was just like a form of a goblin. I think a Grinch is a goblin, right?
I don't know about that. It's,
you don't think the Grinch is a goblin?
Not really. I think a Grinch is a Grinch. I think it's its own thing. And especially, like, I don't think that we need
any. He is very goblin-like.
I don't think that we need. He might be a type of goblin or some furry cousin. Like,
yeah.
It's possible. I consider, like, I could address Grant's character as, like, my furry cousin. But he, like, the real thing is that in monster creation, you only really, like, there's no reason to just label him a goblin. Like, why right. not just say that he's a Grinch?
I mean, he is a Grinch.
There's no mechanical distinction.
No, but the reason I said, like, I guess a Grinch is a type of goblin is because I feel like we might wind up with a party of goblins, because you're playing a goblin and Sarah has not yet decided. And if we've got a group of goblin players, then that at least has potential narrative impact on establishing, like, where you all came from, because you all came from the same dungeon. And it could be, there could be just a big goblin theme running in the background of the campaign, potentially. That's really the only reason I wanted to probe deeper about, is a Grinch a goblin? But, I mean, he's a Grinch. And, yeah, it seems like disrupting some kind of winter solstice or Yuletide holiday, it seems like that's going to be a big factor in it, too. So yeah, we're going to have at least a winter theme, if not a Grinch who stole Christmas theme.
Yeah. I'm excited. I'm excited to get into it. I'm excited to create that world and everything. Like, I'm excited to start.
More than anything, I'm just excited to get into the session zero stuff where, you know, characters are created, but also filling in those narrative details.
It's gonna be a cold snowy night instead of rainy.
Yeah, cold snowy night, where we figure out our sandbox, decide on the different factions there, start up the dungeon, like all the early game table setting. That stuff holds a lot of appeal for me. And I too am excited to get into it and see how this all goes. But this is an interesting experience for me because I don't find Wicked Ones as intuitive as I did something like City of Mist. And I think part of the reason for that is what I said before, where it feels like this is trying to have it both ways. It's trying to be very sort of narrative focused and kind of defaults to the explanation for a lot of things being, and the players and the GM work together to come up with the best idea for the story. But then at the same time, it has a lot of systems, a lot of subsystems, a lot of sections that have a lot of rules to them. And I have not found the concert between those two facets.
Interesting. Well... So, is that it for our episode?
I guess so. I mean, we're going to have a lot more Wicked Ones stuff to cover coming up. I guess this time it was just sort of like further thoughts on Wicked Ones now that you and I have dug more into the rules.
Yeah, I was wondering if there was anything else from my solo experience that I had to share. I did draw out a little dungeon. I did create a little sandbox. That was actually a big thing, is that I created a sandbox. And as a solo player, that is like a lot of work. There's a lot of this to where I'm like, oh man, I wish that I was playing with a group. Like, it doesn't lend itself to being a solo game in terms of, like, it just puts a lot of workload on one person.
Right. Yeah, this was something I also said to you when you were messaging me about it, is I do suspect that the solo rules just aren't fully balanced towards single play. Like, they might fill in a few gaps, but my suspicion is definitely that there is this imbalance that creates, it's like the same amount of work, but for only one person instead of three or four.
Yeah, like, they tell you to basically do session zero and one as written for regular, and, like, that's just so much. It also doesn't translate that well. Like, I don't know. I'd rather they had done a whole separate chapter about the solo thing, but what are you gonna do? Yeah. All right. Well, that was episode 169. If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. Or if you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials, hopefully some pictures of stuff from that I did in Roll20 and whatnot, that'll be in comparingcampaign.wordpress.com.
Level up, get that dungeon?
I mean, yeah, go pillaging and increase your dungeon's tier. But I'm not going to tell you when to do that. It's just up to you guys.
Go on a raid. Avoid the blowback. Hope you don't suffer a calamity.
Bom-ba-dum-bom. 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 Good luck.